Genesis 38. Remember when the last time we were together, Joseph's brothers had sold him as a slave to the Ishmaelites or the Midianites, and they've taken him down into Egypt. And as we move into chapter 38, it almost seems to go off on a little rabbit trail. It goes off and follows Judah. Remember, Judah was with the brothers, and you know, we can only speculate, but maybe Judah was so heartbroken at seeing his dad's heart broken in receiving the death of his son, or apparently the death of his son, that he just had to get out of Hebron. And maybe that's why he took off and ends up where we're going to find him this morning. Remember, Judah is one of Jacob's 12 sons. Joseph, the other of Jacob's 12 sons, sold as a slave into Egypt. And so we look at verse 1 of chapter 38. It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now again, they were in Hebron, and Adullam is maybe 15 miles northwest of Hebron. So he's left the father's clan. He's moved to Adullam and got a certain bud there named Hira. And it says, and Judah saw there, verse 2, a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. He was at Chezib when she bore him. Now, it's interesting because Abraham was so particular on who his son Isaac married that he sent his servant Eliezer all the way back to his family's house in Haran to find the right woman, Rebekah, for him. And it's the same deal with Isaac and Rebekah, with Jacob. They wanted to send Jacob back to his father's house, or to Rebekah's brother, Laban, and get a wife back there. But here Judah takes off and he marries a Canaanite. This would later be forbidden under the law of Moses, and he starts a family. He's got three children now, and it says in verse 6, then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. Now, we're not told what Ur did, but obviously it was something the Lord didn't like, and so Ur was killed. Obviously, some time has passed here, because we read within a few verses that Judah had some children. Now those children are getting married. In fact, there's 22 years that pass between Joseph being sold as a slave into Egypt until Jacob and company actually move down into Egypt. The interesting thing is the only information we have on Jacob's family, as far as what's going on during those 22 years back in Hebron, is what we're reading in chapter 38 this morning. Verse 8 says, and Judah said to Onan, go in to your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. So this was a custom back then. It was called the levirate marriage, taken from the Latin word lever. I mean, that's how we get it. It comes to us today. And it simply means husband's brother. And the idea was, is if a guy who was married and had no children died, then it was the obligation of his brother to marry that woman, and the first child they would have would actually be counted as the dead brother's son, and that would be the heir of the estate. In fact, in Deuteronomy 25:5, it says, if brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. Again, this is known as the levirate marriage. You remember when the Sadducees came to Jesus and they came up with this hypothetical story and said, you know, there were these seven brothers and this one man married this woman, but he died childless. And so the second brother took her as wife, but they didn't have any children. And likewise did all the seven. Then, okay, whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? Hypothetical story, the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, and Jesus simply said, you err. You err not knowing the power of God nor the scriptures. So that was the idea there in that case, the levirate marriage. Also, the book of Ruth, you remember that, where Boaz wanted to marry Ruth, but there was one next of kin that was closer to her than Boaz was. And so Boaz went to this next of kin and said, hey, there's a field to be purchased. The guy said, I'll purchase it. But Boaz said, if you purchase the field, you got to take Ruth as wife too. And he said, no, thank you. And so Boaz was able to get Ruth. This same type of law is being introduced in that point too. It's happening now. It's the custom of the day. It later would become codified under the law of Moses. So Onan's supposed to take her as wife. This is what takes place. Verse 9. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went in to his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord. Therefore he killed him also. Onan's sin was in not fulfilling his duty to his dead brother's wife. He didn't want a child that would not be his heir. Child number two, gone. Judah only has one child left. Verse 11 says, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die like his brothers. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Judah did not know why his sons were dying. He probably thought that Tamar was cursed. So he puts off giving his last child to Tamar, probably hoping that the problem will simply go away. But it won't. Verse 12, now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. So what Tamar has done is she's taken off the widow clothing and has put on the clothing of a prostitute. And she's sitting in the way where Judah is going to be coming because she's seen that Shelah has grown up. Judah has not fulfilled his promise, and so Tamar is taking matters into her own hand. It says in verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Then he turned to her by the way and said, please let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? And he said, I will send a young goat from the flock. So she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? Then he said, what pledge shall I give you? So she said, your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand. Then he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Now Timnah, just a little bit northwest of where Adullam was at, he went up there to shear his sheep. Again, here is Tamar dressed up as a harlot. Judah doesn't know it. He goes into her. She gets pregnant. Again, the pledge that was given was a signet ring and the staff until Judah would send back one of the goats. A signet ring was actually like your identification badge. It was something that you would take and press into a piece of clay so that the person who had whatever document you were stamping knew that you had officially signed that. A couple of archaeological discoveries that date back around 1000 BC there of actual signet rings that they had probably would have been strung with a cord and either around the neck or maybe even through the top of a staff. So this is what Judah has left with Tamar as a pledge until he returns. Verse 19, so she arose and went away and laid aside her veil and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside? And they said, there was no harlot in this place. So he returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. Also the men of the place said, there was no harlot in this place. Then Judah said, let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. And it came to pass, about 3 months after, that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out, and let her be burned. Now, the penalty for someone who committed adultery under the law of Moses was death by stoning. I think we'd thin out the population a lot if we were under the law of Moses. If it was a priest's daughter, it would be death by burning. And it's not to say that this girl was a priest's daughter, but this is what Judah wanted to do. And you can kind of read between the lines and see what he's doing. He wants to get rid of this girl he thinks is jinxed so that his younger son won't die like the other two sons did. And so in verse 25, we read, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong. Remember, she still has that signet ring. I'm with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet and cord and staff. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give to her Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. So Judah recognizes his fault in the matter, and he basically takes care, it looks like, of Tamar, but doesn't know her as wife anymore. But remember, Tamar has conceived. She's pregnant, and she's going to have a couple of children. So we read on. Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. So in reality, this would be the firstborn with the scarlet thread on his hand. Then it happened as he drew back his hand that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore his name was called Perez, which can mean breakthrough. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Now, I think the reason this is pointed out here is because a number of times we find it a number of times in the Old Testament, that even though the firstborn was to inherit the birthright and the blessing, oftentimes it's the younger child that God really uses, and it's the same as the case right here. Now, we think, okay, why is chapter 38 in our Bible? Why did we need to interrupt the story of Joseph for this? And the reason is what we've just read, to read about the line of Judah. Remember that the promise was given to Abraham that he would have a child. In your seed, singular, all the nations on the earth would be blessed. And that promise was reiterated to Isaac, reiterated to Jacob, that through them, through that line, the Messiah would come. In fact, in the Gospel of Matthew, it says the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. This is the line that's leading all the way to Jesus, and that's why the chapter's in here. Another thing that it's showing us is that Jesus' past, his ancestors, weren't perfect by any means. In fact, there's four women that are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew chapter 1. And all of them have some sort of sordid past. Here, Tamar, she played the harlot. The next one that's mentioned is Rahab, the professional harlot from Jericho. And then there's Ruth, a Moabite. And then there's Bathsheba, the one who committed adultery with King David. What does this tell us? Well, I'll tell you what it tells me. It doesn't really matter what my family's done. God can still use me. It also tells me it really doesn't matter what my past has been like. I can still go on from here, and I believe God can use me too. And we're going to touch on a little different angle of that as we make our way through the next chapter and looking at Joseph, getting back to the story again. Remember that Joseph was sold by his brothers as a slave to Egypt because of their jealousy. That's where we took it off before. Now, Egypt has been around for about 1,000 years. Joseph is taken down there. He's been stripped of his robe of many colors, but he cannot be stripped of his God. We read time and again through this chapter that God was with him. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. Now Joseph has gotten pretty much a bum deal, being sold by his brothers as a slave. One thing I want you to take note of is Joseph didn't get down into Egypt and sulk. He didn't just sit in a corner going, woe is me. He put his hand to the plow, so to speak, and he began to work for this slave owner that he was under, Potiphar. Actually, Potiphar, it says, was the captain of the guard. In some translations, it's the captain of the bodyguard. In some margins of your Bibles, it says he's chief executioner of Pharaoh's court. So Joseph is sold here to Potiphar, And he puts his hand to the plow, and what does it say of him? It says that he's successful. It says all he did prospered. And then he was put as an overseer. And so everything virtually was under Joseph's authority here. So it was, we read on, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. One thing I want you to take note of again is that the Lord was blessing Potiphar's household, just like the Lord blessed Laban's flocks when Jacob was faithful in doing what he did. This is another key thing for us who are employees. If we'll work as unto the Lord, like it says in Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men, then the Lord will bless what you're doing and ultimately will be blessing your employer. That's going to be a powerful witness to your employer of who you are and what a Christian really is. The last part of verse 6 tells us that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. The same thing is said of his mom Rachel, like mother, like child. They were good-looking people, and this is where it leads us. It says in verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Notice the contrast here between Joseph and his brother Judah in the last chapter. Joseph's really a man of integrity, isn't he? A man who stands up for what he believes in. He refers to this adultery as wickedness. But did you notice he said, how can I do this great sin against God? Not against your husband or not against my own body or even the law of God, but how can I do this great sin against God? David was like that too. You remember when David committed adultery with Bathsheba, had her husband Uriah the Hittite put to death? Well, Nathan the prophet came in, basically told this made-up story to pin David against the wall. He said, you remember there was this rich man that took this poor man's sheep and killed it. And David said, that man should die for taking advantage of the poorer guy. And Nathan said, you are that man. And David said, and I often tell the story like this, David said, I have sinned. And my point usually in telling the story is, then Nathan said, and the Lord has forgiven your sin. You see, if you confess your sin, the Lord will forgive you. But literally what David said was, I have sinned against the Lord. And in Psalm 51, this psalm where David cries out to God because of his sin with Bathsheba, he says, against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight. Well, it's not to take away from the fact that he sinned against Uriah the Hittite and had him put to death, and that he broke God's law. But the way David saw it, it's like, I sinned against you and you alone. And I think what this speaks of is David and Joseph's relationship with the Lord. You see, when they sinned, they knew it wasn't just some little commandment they were breaking. They knew that they were going straight against the God that they loved. And I think this speaks volumes to you and I. Because as we grow in our relationship with the Lord, we're going to grow closer to him, and we're going to look at sin like Joseph is, for what it is, wickedness. And we know that if we enter into sin, then it's going to be against our God that we love so much. I think there's a good example here, great example here with Joseph. Well, moving on from here, it says in verse 10, so it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her, check this out, or to be with her. In other words, I think it's saying he wasn't even around her. He made it possible, so he didn't even get in her vicinity. Now, something to take note of is that Joseph was in Potiphar's house, some estimate, for 11 years. So he had to deal with this for 11 years. And wisdom, friends, is not going near the temptation or the tempter. It's to steer clear from it, to set up those boundaries that are going to keep you safe. But it happened, verse 11. About this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Paul told Timothy, flee youthful lusts. Run away from it. You know, the Bible tells us, Paul writing to the Corinthians, he says, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. That means we're all generally tempted by the same basic things. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Sometimes the way of escape is physically running the other way. And this is what Joseph did. He knew he had to physically get out of there. I think if all of us were honest with ourselves, we would admit that God has always given us a way of escape. We usually pass on it and we end up falling into sin, various kinds of sin. But he's always faithful to give us that way of escape. Tragically, too many people have failed in this kind of discipline, in not getting around the tempting situation, failed when it got so difficult to not turn and run the other direction. Paul, again talking to the Corinthians just a chapter earlier, said this, do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? What he's doing here is he's comparing the Christian's walk, the Christian's life, with an athletic race. He said, run in such a way that you may obtain the prize. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. That means they exercise self-control, or they go into strict training. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. A guy who runs in a race, a guy who runs in the Olympics, he goes into strict training. For what? For a gold medal. What about us? We've got eternal rewards we're looking at. This is the race we're running in. Paul said, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Paul said, I'm doing everything I can to live the disciplined lifestyle, to steer clear of the temptations, to turn and physically run if need be the other direction. Why? Because I don't want to be set on the shelf. Tragically, too many people have been set on the shelf. In my short time as a Christian, I've seen a number of Christian evangelists being used powerfully for God, but then falling in to this kind of sin. This kind of sin which is hard for people to get over. This kind of sin that damages their credibility so much that they're really literally set on the shelf to where God really can't use them how he did in times past. Now, it's not to say that God does not forgive. He does. But we have to bear the consequences of our sin. And I've seen many a good preacher set on the shelf, not really used again, not in the capacity anyway. And so what do we do? What's the example here? The example of Joseph, one who has integrity with God, is one who steers clear of the temptation and one who turns and runs the other direction when it's facing him right in his face. And so that's the same kind of thing we need to follow. Great example with Joseph here. Well, he's still going to end up in trouble, but he's going to have his integrity with God. It says in verse 13, and so it was when she saw that he left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. And Joseph's being falsely accused. Again, he's kind of had a bum rap through a lot of this. But he kept his integrity, didn't he? You know, in the end, he's going to stand before God, and that's what you and I have to look at. No matter what befalls us now, we need to stand right with the Lord. Look at what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, beginning from verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Tell you what, if you're falsely accused, if you're persecuted, you're in good company. For so they did to the prophets. It's happened to Joseph. But you know what? God is still with Joseph. God is going to be with him, and he's going to work in the situation. When we take up the story from verse 19, "So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, 'Your servant did to me after this manner,' that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. Now Potiphar had the power to put Joseph to death." Again, he's possibly Pharaoh's chief executioner. And a slave that was accused of raping Potiphar's wife could easily have incurred the death penalty. What does this tell us? It tells us that Potiphar knew probably what happened. He loved Joseph. He knew the kind of man Joseph was, 11 years in his house watching God bless him and prosper him. And also, who knows how many years with his wife and, you know, knowing what character she was of. He did probably the only thing he could do is take Joseph and put him into prison. Now, one little side note, some people say this, it's really, I think, impossible to know. Some people say that in order to be an officer of Pharaoh, you'd have to be a eunuch, which means you're castrated, which means that Potiphar and Potiphar's wife, you know, wouldn't have had relations. And so they kind of factor this into the story. I mean, it's no excuse, obviously, but it might add a little more color to some of the reasonings behind what's going on, as if the story needed any more color. Verse 21, we read, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper." Again, it doesn't matter really what happens to us. If God be for us, who can be against us? Do you notice how God is raising Joseph up in every situation? Back at home in his dad's household, he was given the coat of many colors. He was to be the ruler in the household. In Potiphar's house, he was the ruler. In the prison, he's the ruler. And when he gets out of prison, he's going to be a ruler. He's going to be second in command over all of Egypt. It says in the last part of verse 23 that the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. This reminds me of Psalm 1, which says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night." This is the result. "He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The man who delights not in wickedness, but delights in the law of the Lord, meditates in it day and night, fellowships with the Lord, has a strong relationship with the Lord, will be blessed, will be prospered, no matter what the circumstances." In closing, let's just look at a few parallels again between Joseph and Jesus. First of all, in our chapters we looked at, or just in this chapter we looked at, both were falsely accused. You remember when Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate, the accusation was, is he's forbidding people to pay taxes, a false accusation. Both of them did not retaliate. We don't read of Joseph saying anything here when Potiphar's wife is accusing him. And it's said of Jesus in Isaiah 53:7, "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth." Both of them were numbered with criminals. It says of Jesus again in Isaiah 53 that he was numbered with the transgressors. We know that he was crucified between two thieves. Number four, God was with them. It says of Jesus in John, "The Father has not left me alone, for I always do those things that please him." And finally, God would ultimately use it for good. Genesis 50, verse 20, when Joseph's brothers come to him after Jacob has died, Joseph says to them, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive." God was working behind the scenes of all of this, and he was going to use these situations, these unfortunate circumstances, to keep the nation of Israel alive through the famine, bringing them down into Egypt, and also the parallel. God used the crucifixion so that every single one of us can be forgiven of our sins and spend eternity with him. That's the most important thing. Jesus has died for you and I so that we can be forgiven, so that we can spend eternity with him. And he can work all things together for good in your life as well. Keep trusting in him. Be like Joseph, no matter what your circumstance. Keep plugging through and trusting in your God. All right?